You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to the SmartCast Microlearning podcast series on ulcerative colitis hosted by Med Learning Group. My name is Kia Jones, Medical Director at Med Learning Group, and I will be the host for today's podcast. This is the fifth and final installment in the series titled Treatment Selection in Ulcerative Colitis, Optimizing Outcomes Through Patient-Centered Decision-Making. Today's podcast will focus on the role of advanced practice providers in delivering patient-centered UC care. Joining me today is Nicole Thomas, family nurse practitioner at the Mount Sinai Hospital, Leonard and Feinstein IBD Center in New York, New York. Welcome, Nicole. It is so good to have you with us today.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Absolutely. So advanced practice providers, or APPs, as we all know, play a significant role in managing chronic diseases such as UC, and this role is ever expanding. Can you talk a little about what your role entails working as a nurse practitioner in an IBD center?
Yes, so the role of the advanced practice provider in treating patients with ulcerative colitis is definitely essential in healthcare today. There are so many sick patients and only so many doctors. So really the role of the advanced practice provider, at least in our setting, is to help support the physicians by being the liaison to the patient. In general, nurse practitioners manage patients both in the outpatient and the inpatient setting. We see both routine follow-up patients, we see sick patients, and we see incredibly urgent patients. And a lot of nurse practitioners also see our patients when they're incredibly sick and need to be hospitalized in the hospital setting. We're responsible for meeting the patients, having follow-up visits. In our visits, we often will do their health histories. We go through all of their symptoms. We examine the patients. We order blood tests, colonoscopies, imaging. We make referrals to our interdisciplinary teams, and we also make referrals to other physicians such as dermatologists, rheumatologists, colorectal surgeons as needed. Nurse practitioners also, if not directly, often indirectly, work with the clinical studies as well. If we're not directly related to the studies, we will often know the studies that are going on and be able to send patients to clinical trials when either medication options have run out or if they're looking for some alternative pathway to help advance research.
That's really interesting. And, it sounds like you're involved in nearly all the aspects of patient care. With IBD, specifically UC, it's largely managed by gastroenterologists and, when needed, colorectal surgeons. And you kind of touched on this already, as with most chronic conditions, ideal management would take place in a multidisciplinary team. So with that, again, I think you touched on it briefly, in managing or coordinating multidisciplinary care, exactly what is the role of the APP?
Sure. I mean, that's actually one of our biggest roles. We provide high-level, complex, multidisciplinary care coordination. We're often the liaisons between our patients, their physician, their colorectal surgeons, the ostomy nurses, the social workers, the nutritionists, the psychologists. We're their first line. They come to us. They know we respond quickly. They know how to get a hold of us. Basically what we do is we're the patient's quarterback. They come to us, they say, listen, I have this problem. I know it's like maybe not your role, but how do I navigate this? And we're responsible for, if we don't know, finding out. And usually we do know, though. These are problems that happen over and over again. I can't get a hold of my dietitian. I need help with this bill. I need an appeal with my insurance. My copay was very high. And we're the people who help send them in the right direction. And if we don't know, we have a very nice team who helps us often. We have a lot of people we work with, medical assistants, like I said, the pharmacists, the social workers, who are all, infinitely resourceful and incredibly helpful. And we couldn't do our jobs without them. We also help them, with a new research. We help them navigate peer-reviewed medications that they might be asking us about. Let's see, you know, it's important for APNs also to be up to date with their American Gastroenterological Association recommendations, as well as our board certifications. And also, like we had mentioned briefly before, staying up to date with whichever studies are being conducted, whether it's at our office or not, just to know kind of what's around in other other offices maybe nearby that we might not even know.
Got it. Again, I am in complete awe of all that APPs do. I mean, the list just seems like it is ongoing. And obviously, your role is critical. And, you know, the team or the operation would not be able to function without the APPs. So when it comes specifically to assessment and routine monitoring and management of patients with UC, what's the involvement of APPs?
So what I like to do is when I'm seeing a patient for follow-up, whether it's a sick or a routine visit, I always do the same recipe. I start with what I call housekeeping. We go through, have there been changes to your medical history? Have there been changes to your medications? We make sure all the medications are up to date, not only the names, but the dose. And how frequently they take it. I then go through their family medical history. I ask, has anyone in your family had any changes in their medical history, which can definitely help us change management. I also at that time ask about any tobacco history, illicit drug history, alcohol use. I make sure I update this at every visit. It's incredibly important. These things do change and we feel like we know the patients well, but I have often seen changes in these things and they help us to understand what's going on with the patient often. Even, you know, their what may be going on at home. Have they had any job changes, any stressors? These things we know can increase risk of flares in patients with ulcerative colitis. I then go down the line. I ask them objectively their symptoms or lack thereof, maybe. Are they compliant with their medications, which is incredibly important, as you might imagine. I ask them what their stool is like. Are they having diarrhea? Are they having constipation? Are they having rectal bleeding? Have they had an infection recently? Have they been on antibiotics recently? Have they had to use NSAIDs, which can cause symptoms as well? Any changes in diet history? Have they recently become gluten-free for some reason? Have they recently been eating a non-fat diet? All of these things can contribute to their symptoms. So I find out how they're feeling. I ask all those important questions, and then I go on to listen to any questions they may have. Finally, after finding out all of these things, we make a good plan. Have they had a colonoscopy recently? If so, we go over the results, we review recent lab work, we go over those results, as well as any MRI or imaging studies they may have had. Were they recently in the emergency room? That's important as well. So basically, we go over all those things, we find out what they're due for, whether it's for health maintenance or to manage or to help us manage a flare. If they're flaring, we might order special tests that they need, such as an MRI enterography, MRI of the pelvis, depending what's going on. We might order a colonoscopy, even if they had it 6 months ago. So they might have been feeling well then. We might order one now to see now they're flaring. How extensive is the disease? Is their medication working? That's another reason we would order another either colonoscopy or MRI. To decide, we started you on a new medication 6 months ago. Is it working? Then we would do our follow-up to check for endoscopic healing. It's important, even if the patient is feeling well, to make sure that down to the mucosa after starting new medications, it is working. Another important thing that we always review is health maintenance. Have you had your annual colonoscopy? Have you done your routine screening, such as GYN for women at least annually? We recommend it when people are on biologics. We also recommend a dermatology visit once a year for a full body skin check, more often if they, obviously if there are findings, and then a annual ophthalmology visit where they can look at the optic nerve, make sure there is no inflammation which can be associated with ulcerative colitis and chronic disease. We also recommend annual flu vaccines. We make sure the pneumonia vaccines are up to date, and we make sure that patients are immune to hepatitis B as well, typically. That's mostly it for health maintenance off the top of my head. But we have this nice cornerstone checklist that we like to refer to make sure that we get everything.
Got it. Wow, that's really, really interesting. And I imagine being involved really across the entire course of disease management allows APPs, you know, a unique opportunity to foster like real connections with patients. So like over the course of the podcast series, we've talked a lot about the wide range of therapies approved for use in patients with UC. Just yesterday, mirikizumab received FDA approval for the treatment of adults with moderate to severe UC. So it's very exciting, I'm sure, for the field. But while these agents provide new opportunities for improved outcomes, they also add increased complexity and uncertainty about which ones are appropriate for a given patient. So with that, what is the role of APPs in helping patients navigate through therapy selection in UC?
Of course, first and foremost, medical management is always guided by using evidence-based therapies for considering patients with comprehensive healthcare needs. We make sure that we review what patients have been on previously, have tried and failed, may have worked initially and then stopped working or didn't work at all, because a lot of our medications are under the same mechanism of action. So for example, if we are using one mechanism of action in the past, it didn't work at all, we wouldn't choose a medication like that with the same mechanism of action. We would choose something different. If it had worked before and then stopped working, we may consider using that same mechanism again. An example would be Remicade and Humira have the same mechanism of action. For patients, it's also important to consider cost and insurance coverage. Not all medications are covered equally, unfortunately, so it's not always exactly the provider's recommendation. We always try to go for that first, but sometimes we run into situations where an insurance will request a different medication to be tried before the one the provider has requested. In those cases, we always appeal to the end of the line because we trust that our providers have the most experience and that what they're recommending is the best, not what the insurance company is recommending. But sometimes the insurance company does win and we have to go with what they recommend first. Typically, we also discuss with the patient what we think they will be most compliant with. There are different ways patients can get medications. One is oral. Another is a self-injector at home, and another one is by an infusion at an infusion center or by a nurse at your house. There's also a combination where you start with an infusion at an infusion center or with a nurse at your house, and then it is followed by self-injections. We like to give the patients a few options if they're available, so that way they can consider their lifestyle and what might be easier for them, college kid who's back and forth between their college state and their home state might recommend something that's always self-injected. They can get it delivered wherever they are. They can self-inject easy. An older gentleman or woman, for example, might want to go to an infusion center and have someone else do it for them. Somebody who may not remember to take a pill every day might not want a pill every day. And also safety is, of course, our number one topic. We have to make sure that what we're providing is a good safety profile for the patient. So we have to take into consideration their age, what kind of work they might do, what kind of lifestyle they live, and make sure that whatever we're providing is safe and appropriate.
Absolutely. Those are all very, very good points. Now, you mentioned education and, you know, wanting to provide options for patients based on, you know, their lifestyle and what may be important to them. And as we kind of touched on previously, you know, APPs are key points of contact for UC patients. And by developing that strong and trusted relationship with patients over an extended period of time, APPs are positioned to provide holistic care, which is obviously paramount and is very important in achieving effective or for patients achieving effective self-management. So what are some strategies you use to communicate and educate and ultimately advocate for patients in this arena?
So mostly it's important that patients are able to communicate with us first. It's important that during our visits, we tell patients the best way to communicate with us. That way they can let us know what's going on and we can be their voice and their advocate for whatever the problem may be. You know, we often too will pick up things that the patient may not. We might see them in a visit and realize, you know what, they're really struggling at home or at work or in their, you know, whatever personal life, and they need our social worker, and we will offer it. We have lots of programs, thankfully, and a lot of IBD centers around the country are starting to realize how important all of these different programs are. So we are able to offer social work who can help with socioeconomic issues, insurance issues, and also depression, anxiety issues with coping mechanisms. If somebody is really feeling down, depressed, anxious, we also have psychologists who are able to assist. We often recommend our dietitian, who patients always say, "What can I eat? What can I eat?" And we can offer them, of course, some short-term solutions, but it's always better to send them to the person who does this all the time, who's an expert in nutrition and ulcerative colitis. So we're able to send them to our nutritionist, and we also have pharmacists. We're able to help patients to navigate this like very difficult diagnosis oftentimes by offering them what they don't even know we have in our office.
And it sounds like, you know, specifically within your center, you guys are, you know, you have everything that a patient would need in order to, you know, achieve that optimal holistic care. So, you know, as is with healthcare in general, you know, I'm sure there are barriers or challenges that you experience in providing patient-centered care for ulcerative colitis. Can you talk a little bit about those barriers or challenges?
Yeah, so one of the biggest barriers we see that can definitely frustrate this patient as well as the team is insurance barriers. That is one of the biggest things that we see. We are constantly every day fighting with insurance to get patients approved for medications, you know, from rectal therapy all the way up to Remicade therapy. We have to fight with them constantly. You know, we also have to fight to get MRIs approved, to get colonoscopies approved, to get any kind of testing that we want. It often comes back denied initially by insurance. So that's one of the biggest barriers. Another one is even once things are approved, cost. It seems that a lot of insurances have high copays nowadays. And so patients have an exorbitant cost to even getting their routine colonoscopies to screen them for colon cancer, which they're, of course, even more high risk for than the regular population. So we do our best to make it as easy as possible for the patients and tell them, listen, let us worry about this. We'll take this off of you and we'll handle it. And so we handle it as best we can. We try to let the patient know every step of the way where we're at with it. Another barrier, of course, can be socioeconomic. Sometimes patients can't get to the clinic. They live far away, but they depend on us. So one thing that's helped with that is virtual visits. We're able, as long as they're in New York State, to see patients for a virtual visit or a Zoom visit, which is really convenient. We can then send them blood work to do locally. That helps with that barrier. Some of the other barriers that I have written down are just understanding of their disease. Sometimes patients don't understand their disease, the long-term effects, that this is a chronic disease that will have to be managed for a lifelong at this point until we hopefully find a cure. And that's hard for them to understand, that this isn't something where I take a medication and it goes away, that I have to constantly be managing it. And so it's important just to make sure that we help them with their expectations of their disease. Another barrier would be cultural, I think. Different cultures or different ages even, they might deal with their disease differently. And so it's important for us to listen to the patients, find out exactly what it is that's maybe causing their hesitation to do a procedure, hesitation to take a certain kind of medication that we recommended, and help them navigate that.
Wow. You know, it sounds like there's still a lot of room for improvement, you know, and I'm sure, you know, that's with a lot of disease states. There's lots of room for improvement, you know, in UC care, but it's clear that the multifaceted role played by APPs is critical in bridging that gap. This has truly been an interesting and enlightening conversation. I thank you so much for joining us today to share your expertise. We definitely learned a lot.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you to our listeners for joining us. This podcast is brought to you by Med Learning Group. Med Learning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. I would like to also give a special thank you to our grant supporter, Lily, who provided an unrestricted grant for this educational activity.